You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
7.5 years ago, I got thyroid cancer. And the average life expectancy of somebody in my situation was 14 months.
So let's look at like a best case scenario. You're looking at a maximum of 3 years.
That's about right, yeah.
When you first realized the full depth of what was happening, what was your first reaction?
Immediately, everybody became very important to me. Immediately, time became super important to me. The desire to connect with the meaning overwhelmed the time I had for the meaningless. You know, life is just way too short to get paid to hang out with people you don't like.
Can they ever make, like, I don't know, robots the size of cells that just go through and find all the cells and patch them up?
I mean, that's the science fiction, you know, the nanotech stuff. I don't know that they're anywhere close to doing something like that. One thing that people always say to me is, you know, I can't imagine what it would be like to go through what you're going through. And to what I always say to them, neither can I. Like, my brain can't fathom it any more than your brain can. It's just this fact that is unimaginable.
I've got on the show a very special guest, Mike Van Cleave. Mike, how's it going?
It's going very well, thank you.
So, Mike, I would think it's fair to say 20 years ago, we were probably like best friends.
That's definitely true, yes.
We used to go to comedy clubs together. We worked together. We'd play chess together literally every single day for years.
Yes.
This is probably like a 3-year period.
Something like that, yeah.
We went to Aspen, the Aspen Comedy Festival. Probably traveled around other places. I can't remember other places. But we lost touch as these things go. We got back in touch a year ago, and we're talking and talking and talking. And then you were like, oh, that's right. You don't know. I've been diagnosed with terminal cancer.
Yeah.
And this was just about a year ago, maybe less than a year ago.
Yeah, it was 9 months ago. It was in February.
Yeah, 9 months ago. And when they first diagnosed you, correct me if I'm wrong, you were given a few months to live or 6 months to live.
Well, they were unclear about it. You know, I mean, because there's just a tremendous amount of ambiguity with cancer. I mean, what I did know was the average life expectancy of somebody in my situation was 14 months.
What kind of cancer was it?
It is, well, so it was actually 7.5 years ago, I got thyroid cancer, and 99% of the cases is beatable. And so—
It's like Barbara Bush got thyroid cancer, right?
I actually don't know, but okay. I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. It's fairly common, actually, as far as cancers go.
When you first realized the full potential outcome and depth of what was happening, what was your first reaction?
My first reaction was I thought of all the people I wanted to see, and I realized that I wouldn't be able to see them. And so, you know, going—
Because there were so many people?
Yeah, and actually going just slightly back, when you were asking what did they tell me, at one point I said to the doctor, when she just said, well, you already understand it. And I said, well, like, you know, can you give me a sense, like, you know, 6 months, 12 months, or, you know, should I keep working? Should I, you know, do this other stuff? And she said, I can tell you this. I would strongly try to enjoy the next 6 months of your life. Mm. And that was really the strongest thing that she said at that stage. But again, that matched up with the numbers. And so I knew that, you know, if untreated, it would get, you know, the end that I just described would still happen no matter what. So I already knew that. And so then I was just like, how could I see, you know, every person who was important to me? And so what I ended up doing was I went through my social media accounts, and I went through my email, every email I'd ever sent that I could find, really every email since Gmail, and then emailed every person in my life that I had their contact information to, and said, I'm having a party, and I'd really like you to come to this party, and it's okay if you can't, but here's what's going on.
And you didn't explain the reason for the party?
Oh, no, I explained to everybody. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, and so that was a very shocking letter for a lot of people to get. And, it was in January in France, in the countryside. And I thought maybe 20 people would show up. And then it was really, really overwhelming because almost 200 people came to the party. Hmm. And they flew in from all over the world. My best friend from junior high, who I hadn't spoken to in over 20 years, showed up. It was just really amazing. Hmm.
And so what did you do? Did you quit your job?
Oh, yeah. No, I quit my job.
You quit your job instantly, like the next day?
Pretty much, yeah.
So.
It took a little bit. I was working in a startup at that stage, and I was...
But there's no more dreams of like, oh, the startup's going to work out, and I'm going to get wealthy for the next 30 years.
No, I don't care.
Right. So suddenly...
In fact, I still own shares in that company. I had a conversation with the current CEO, and mm-hmm. he was talking about buying me out or not buying me out or, keeping me on. And I was just like, I don't care. I mean, like, whatever you want to do. I'll sell you the shares. I won't sell you the shares. You tell me. It doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
I don't have kids. Don't anticipate having kids. So what do I care? And it'll just be, my goal is to die with $5 in my bank account.
Right. And I mean, I'm having trouble coming up with a question, actually. So, you have this party. You're being you think you have no idea how long you're going to live. At that point, probably when you have the party, you don't know which treatments are going to work for how long. And did you get scared? Were you more scared or sad?
Numb.
Because what sounds scary is not so much the death, but correct me if I'm wrong because I haven't been through this. What sounds scary is not so much the death, but the pain of the death. But what sounds sad is the not seeing people you want to see.
That was my overwhelming feeling before the party, and then after the party, I saw everybody.
But for instance, I think of life and I think, okay, I'm 49. There's still a whole potential second half to my life. Mm-hmm. Anything could happen. It could even be more kids, or there could be more jobs, more opportunities, more things to be creative about. What did you specifically stop thinking about or stop hoping for or stop being anxious about?
Well, I mean, that process was slow. The first couple months before the party, I just became a complete mess. And it was really just
shock. What
does
that mean?
I mean, well, I was drinking too much. I was, not doing anything. Just partying, trying to, just figure stuff out, talking a lot, crying a lot. I can always tell over the years if I'm going through a really tough time, if I cry while I'm watching Modern Family. And I don't know what it is. Every once in a while in Modern Family, I'm just like, oh, Phil loves Claire so much. I just can't stop crying, which I always think it's funny. That's the one show that makes me cry sometimes. But so I just kind of this mess. And I really don't remember that stage very well, honestly. I was just completely in shock. And, one thing that people always say to me is, I can't imagine what it would be like, to go through what you're going through. And to what I always say to them, neither can I. Like, my brain can't fathom it any more than your brain can. And so it's just like this, it's just this fact that is unimaginable.
I feel like there's this other cliche too, which is that, oh, we're all going to die eventually. You just happen to have a little more clarity
yes.
on when it's going to happen. Like, I could go outside today and get hit by a car. But the reality is, if you've lived, let's say I've lived 2,500 weeks so far, the odds are pretty good I'm going to live another one. Like,
right.
I have no reason to think I'm not going to live another week or month or year or whatever. The statistics are sort of on my side to live forever, actually, and then eventually I'll die.
Right, eventually you won't live forever.
Right. Yeah. So it's kind of good until it isn't.
Right.
But you, unlike me, or unlike most people walking around, have kind of this window into, how many months, years, and what will happen during those months and years and so on. So, specifically, what joys do you think, what were the first joys you think you realized you would miss? So obviously the friends were one, but you kind of not solved it, but the cat.
I understand the question, mm-hmm. and I don't know how to answer it because that wasn't my experience. Hmm.
I don't know. So like, what was your experience?
Yeah, I mean, so I wasn't all of a sudden worried about kind of what I would miss. I worried about who I would miss. Mm-hmm. Immediately everybody became very important to me. Immediately time became super important to me.
Oh, well I want to ask this. So if everybody became important to you, who didn't become important to you? You say everyone, but I'm sure not everyone. I'm sure some people actually reduced in importance.
It's very polar now.
Yeah.
If they were important to me, it's very hard for me to not hold on to people in the past who are important. Mm-hmm. You know, like whatever, you know, thing that we had that caused us to quit talking. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was in New York and saw you show up in my social media, I was just like, why wouldn't I talk to that guy? He was a hugely important part of my life. Right. And I don't remember what it was that we did, you know. I mean, actually, you told me what you thought it was, and I thought it was something else. And so like there was just some stupid thing, and that no longer mattered at all. And whether you had done this or done that, or I'd done this or I'd done that, just didn't matter at all anymore. The relationship all of a sudden became the most important thing.
Right, the fact that there was meaning.
There was meaning.
And what relationships did you find that were even current for you, did you realize had no meaning, and so you dropped them?
That was definitely, it wasn't as binary as that, because mm-hmm. it was more that the desire to connect with the meaning overwhelmed the time I had for the meaningless.
Instead of thinking what you're going to miss or what anxieties you're going to get rid of, you just focused on today. And I don't mean to put words in your mouth. I'll let you continue. I'm just trying to understand it. Today, how can I add to the meaning in my life today, or what will provide meaning today?
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, meaning. I mean, the semantics get challenging at some point, but it's like, what's important? You know, what do I want to do? I remember very clearly early on when, you know, I mean, in the beginning, I really thought, you know, no more than a year and a half, maybe two at the outside. And I remember I was really tired one Friday night, and I thought to myself, you have 50 to 75 Fridays left. Like, how could you just sit here? Like, I don't want to spend one of my 50 Friday nights sitting around feeling bad for myself. I'm going to do something. I don't know what, but I'm going to go find something that's better than what I'm currently doing.
Do you remember what you did
that night? I'm sure I went over to a bar and flirted with somebody. It's funny. I've mentioned this to you before, but what I really came away with, and this is cliche, and it's funny, there was a bunch of things I think I figured out that I really wanted to share with people. And at some point I realized, in some ways you can't understand it until you understand it. And, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, talking to a child. Well, by the way, that totally didn't mean that condescendingly.
No, you could condescend.
But I mean, like, in the sense that, like, someday, like your first great heartbreak. You know, everybody's like, it's okay, you'll survive, there'll be another one. But you can't imagine what it would be like because you've never had that happen to you. And so at a certain point, I realize it's a similar thing. It's not that I have a better perspective, I just have a different vantage point that's really hard to understand or to really process, I think. And the one thing that I've come to understand completely is there's only one thing in your life that matters, and that's the quality of your relationships. And you know, it's such a cliche. You can look back at thousands of quotes of people who are old and dying, and they always talk about the people in their lives. Nobody cares about how much money you have when you die. It just doesn't matter. And so most of the things that we sit around, you know, spending our life in, worrying about, you realize at this stage has no meaning. Now, it's important, maybe. You know, it's important that I have a job because I got to pay money. I got to spend money. I got to live. But the job itself only has the importance that you place in it. There's no fundamental intrinsic importance to that. And I was talking to a friend of mine, girlfriend, now fiance, when I first met her, first time I'd ever met her, a really old dear friend of mine, and she came to Paris, and she's a psychologist, and she said, and this was right after I learned. I mean, he got on a plane within a week or two of my learning, and his girlfriend was, and I was very negative, and she was like, you know, hey, Mike, is there anything positive? I mean, I know it's a weird question, but is there, you know, any goodness that's come out of this? And I said, well, yeah, I mean, the one thing I realized is that the only thing that matters in life is relationships. And then, you know, we talked about that for a moment. And then about an hour, 2 hours later, we're you know, it actually gone inside. We're at a cafe. And she said, you know, earlier I heard you say that what's most important to you is the relationships in your life. And I just met her, so I couldn't say anything. I didn't think I could say anything, but I really got annoyed with her because I was like, no, I most certainly did not say that. I did not say what's important to me. I said it's very clear to me that this is the only thing that's important. And it's funny, I keep having these conversations with people all the time. And people kind of are like, yeah, that makes sense. But it doesn't really register because you just behave differently if your relationships are the most important thing in your life.
Well, it's interesting because I do kind of think, I mean, I was just on someone else's podcast earlier this morning and they were asking like, well, it was all like success this, success that. But I said it really does, even success boils down to the quality of the relationships in your life. Like if you have 20 good relationships, let's say you have 20 good people in your company and one bad person, your company is going to go down the tubes. So like a 20-to-1 ratio. You need like everybody to be pretty good or at least 50 to be good and one to be bad to counterbalance it.
Right.
And so I do think that is like a truism, but I think maybe to let's try to be devil's advocate for a second. Clearly, if you have like a bunch of kids that you have to pay for and a wife, you have to pay for their survival after you're dead. And if the wife has been raising the kids, you have to think about them a little bit.
Right, but I would argue that is about the quality of the relationship.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a crappy relationship with them, you don't care about the relationship, you just don't take care of them after you're dead.
And here's another one, and this is going to sound odd, but you have to also take care of your health. So you have to take care of every other aspect of your health. Like you have to eat well and sleep well.
I'm very clearly not saying that's the only thing maybe I did say that, but I'm not saying that the other things aren't important. I'm saying that the quality of your relationships is most important.
Right, because if you spend any time, like if you take one of your 50 Fridays left, mm-hmm. if you spend that Friday with someone you didn't really want to spend that time with, why would you, you know, it almost makes zero sense when you put the math to it.
And the thing is, I'd also say that, like, you know, and I'm not just blowing air up your skirt, but like, I know that you know this, you know, and that's, and what I'm saying is that I find that it's challenging to teach this. Because if you know it, you know it, and it's obvious. And if you don't, you don't. But like, you know, if I read your blog, like half of the things that you talk about are all about relationships. Even if they don't say they're about relationships,
right.
You know, be an idea machine. Think of somebody and send them ideas. You know, that's clearly I'm building a relationship with you. And that's, you know, every successful person I know says that. You know, every happy person I know says that. You know, every unhappy, unsuccessful person I know thinks it's something other than relationships, or they're just really bad at relationships. You know, there was the Harvard study, I can't remember the name of the title, but the longitudinal study that started in the 30s and is still going, the largest study ever done on people. And so, you know, like Kennedy was in that class, like a whole bunch of really famous people were in that class. But what was interesting is that over the kind of 70 years the study's been going on, they came up with three things that are the largest indicators of all positive metrics in your life: happiness, success, financial stability, health. And the three strongest variables in that were, in this order, smoking, drinking, and the quality of your relationships.
I don't understand. What was the smoking and the drinking part?
Well, smoking and drinking are massively negatively correlated.
Oh, I see.
So people, smokers, it turns out, earlier in life, and drinkers, really happy. Things are going great. Woo! But by the time you're 60 or 70, you pay the piper for that. Huh. Which is good news because I'm not going to live to 60 or 70, so I'm not going to have to pay the piper.
We don't know for sure, but
no,
if there's a new drug coming out.
Exactly. We'll cross our fingers. But the people who had the highest quality relationships were the ones who were the happiest, the healthiest, lived the longest, And incidentally, the people who were the happiest, this is around 1970 to 1980 because of the age of that cohort, the people who were happiest, had the best relationships, made on average $250,000 a year more than the people who had lower quality relationships.
Could there be a causal thing there that people who make more somehow attract more friends? I'm just wondering the statistics.
Obviously, this is correlation, not causal.
Yeah. Clearly, it's the quality of the relationships have to be important.
Right.
Does it help to have a lot of high quality relationships, or does that not matter as much?
I say this a lot. I mean, time is your only non-replaceable resource. So, you know, it takes a huge amount of time to build anything of really high quality. And so you got to play a balance in it. I can't have 1,000 friends. You know, I can have 1,000 acquaintances, but those are not really necessarily very high quality. Now, I can still try to have the highest quality acquaintances, but if I tried to have 200 close friends, then I would have no close friends.
Right.
And so there is some balance in there. And I think, I don't really know the statistics. I know it's been studied. I think you can have like no more than 4 or 5 close friends and, you know, 20, I mean, like 4 or 5 really close friends and maybe 20 close friends and, you know, 100 acquaintances or something in that effect. That's the total amount that.
Yeah. Yeah. You ever hear something called the Dunbar number?
No.
So it's, you can basically have 150 people that you, I don't know if it's acquaintances or that you know enough about that you can consider an acquaintance.
Exactly.
And so if you don't have that in your life, then what happens is, which many people don't actually, what happens is then that's where People Magazine and Us Magazine, all these things come in. You think Kim Kardashian, the brain thinks Kim Kardashian's your friend because you're seeing her every day.
James, are you suggesting that Kim Kardashian is not my friend?
That's exactly what I'm suggesting. You've been fooling yourself all this time, inviting her to France.
That's really upsetting.
It's no wonder she's not responded to you.
No, she hasn't. I thought maybe
she's just busy.
It was getting lost in the mail or something.
Right. So I mean, what do you do then? Like sitting here listening to this, what do you suggest to people? Let's say you're invited to a dinner and you don't really feel like going. What do you do?
I make a determination between my time and my commitment to that relationship. You know, I don't want to say it's just mathematical, but it's a fairly simple,
But you can make that mathematical calculation. Let's say someone doesn't know how many, I mean, it almost sounds like too crude to think of it mathematically, but let's say someone doesn't know how much time they have, but they could potentially be seeing this person a lot more. Let's say it's a boss that they don't want to, you know, do this with or that with. What would the solution be? I'm asking you like an oracle of Delphi here.
I mean, again, I think, you know, I mean, like, sometimes for me, I mean, of course, I don't work anymore. It's really, I mean, it's so strange.
I didn't mean like the work kind of thing.
No, I understand.
Let's say if, let's say a girl that's
exactly,
making
you uncomfortable. I was just gonna switch the context. But like, you know, say for example, as you know, this has happened recently, that I met somebody that seemed really interesting to me and I thought that there might be something, I would invest a tremendous amount of time and energy in a short period of time to find out whether that was going to mean something, whether it was going to be meaningful. And then if it isn't, then, you know, I'm going to react differently. So it's kind of, you know, if it was a boss, you know, and it was important, I would probably do it. At the same time, I probably wouldn't work for somebody I really didn't want to spend time with anymore.
Right.
You know, life is just way too short to get paid to hang out with people you don't like.
Now, when you first found out about the diagnosis, you weren't in a romantic relationship?
Nope.
So did that make you sad? The fact that there wasn't somebody who was kind of almost by definition would stick through it with you for that duration? Did you feel sad about that?
That's very complicated. Mm-hmm. There's no easy answer to that. There's parts of it that I've gone through really different periods of it too. There's parts of the time when I'm actually happy in a weird way not to be in that relationship. I don't have near the emotional and physical reserves I did prior to being on the medication. So I don't really know, you know, I have 6 plants in my apartment from 3 years ago, and I think one of them may be doing okay. 3 of them are just dead in their pots. I haven't even bothered to throw them out. So Like I can't care for any living thing right now.
Why do the emotional reserves go down? Because of the actual emotional duress of the situation, or is there a medical reason the emotional reserves go down?
A little bit of both. I mean, the emotional reserves just go down because I'm tired. You know, I only have a few hours a day where I feel really good. It varies from, you know, from time to time. But about a year and a half ago, I left my apartment about 6 hours a week. And the rest of the time, I was just at home on the sofa. And when people would come visit me after about an hour, I'd be just happy for them to go. And so at those moments, I really just didn't have a lot of energy to give to people.
And was that the tail end of one of the drug protocols?
That was actually the beginning of one of the drug protocols where they had me on the maximum dosage and I was reacting very poorly to it.
And I see, so, there were side effects.
Yeah, and so they kept lowering the dose until I was fine.
What about in terms of like starting new, like obviously relationships are important. Romantic relationships are part of relationships. Do you consider starting new ones knowing that, and how do people react to you knowing that there's kind of a timeline on the romantic relationship?
It's, you know, it's challenging. I've recently had my kind of thinking, knocked out of balance on that. I think that I was overestimating the impact of my illness on it. But there's no doubt that it's a big decision to get involved with somebody who you know how it's going to end. And you know that there's going to be a really difficult period of time. And so I find that it has to be certain, you know, certain people at certain places are going to want to be, you know, consider that, and other people just aren't. And I really do understand. It's also very challenging early on in dating because if I don't tell you that I'm sick, then I actually have to hide a lot from you. And I think life's too short to lie and pretend to be something that you're not. And so I want to tell you because I want you to know me and it's such a big part of my life. But you know, on a first date, let me just mention to you stage 4 metastatic cancer. And now, you know, you have an hour and a half conversation because it takes about an hour and a half to work through this the first time when somebody learns it. And I actually, you know, I've told more than, more than 300 people in person at some point about this. And I know almost exactly how the conversation's going to go. And it really does. It takes 45 minutes to 90 minutes, no matter what, to get through all the questions and the initial shock. And that's just horrible first date conversation. But now if you wait to the sixth date, well, this is really awkward because the person's like, I might wanted to have known that actually. That seems like useful information for me.
Right. And have you gone to the sixth date?
No, of course not. Because I overshare. So, you know, sometime in the first two dates, I tell them and then they
seems like it would be hard to even last to the second date before
it's
you tell
really
them.
Hard. Yeah. One of my friends is always just like, dude, just don't tell them. And I'm like, I want to tell them.
Right.
That's who I am.
And so what else has like changed? Obviously you quit your job, kind of hang out in France. You spend time with your family's in Colorado, I know, right? Or Kentucky.
Kentucky, well, they have two houses, so they're either in Kentucky or Colorado. Mm-hmm. They've been in Kentucky for a while. So yeah.
Do you spend as much time as possible with them? I mean, you're living in France, so why don't you spend all your time with them?
Well, one of the major reasons is because of French healthcare. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could get the healthcare that I have in France in the US. Mm. There's certainly no private insurance that I'm aware of that would cover the quality of healthcare that I have.
Are there any kind of rogue countries that don't, I mean, like the FDA, the EMA, like all most of these drug administrations around the world kind of all work together. Are there any kind of rogue countries where just like any drug is on the market and you could try the most experimental things possible?
Probably, but you know, I wouldn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's funny. I talk to it's gross exaggeration. Many times I'm talking to somebody and they come up with like, oh, you know, raw almonds. That's a secret. You just got to eat raw almonds. And, you know, or I don't know what it is.
Does any of that stuff ever work? Like, for instance, I do have one friend who says, this is part of the whole no carb thing. Carbs cause inflammation. That causes the cancer cells to replicate. Just stop immediately, like put your brain in ketosis and all carbs gone. Is there any truth to any of that?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm not an expert, but I don't think so. you know, what causes cancer is, I mean, it's just a random defect. And so now I think you can make a strong, I mean, you could make theoretically a strong argument that a certain lifestyle or food choice would actually increase the likelihood of that genetic failure occurring. But once the failure has occurred, it's just simple chemistry at that stage, you know? And so it's,
you can't like starve the cancer cells of a particular nutrient that they need.
No, because the thing is the cancer cells are just slightly unhealthy cells. Hmm. I mean, they're just, the only thing that's wrong with them is that they are not supposed to be there. Hmm. But you know, these are thyroid cells in my body. And so they're just thyroids. And so they're, you know, the body can't tell the difference between those thyroids as healthy thyroid cells and non-healthy thyroid cells. But
by the way, if you have all these many thyroids, do they generate hormones or no? That part they
don't.
Well,
that's why I say they do. That's the cancer marker, is that they measure the thyroglobulin, which is the thyroid hormone I don't take because it's not used. Mm. And so they can see how much the thyroids are producing.
But are they also producing testosterone or anything like that?
No, because they only produce T1, T2, and T3 hormones.
But those go into the pituitary gland, you said, and potentially produce these other hormones, or no?
Well, the thing is that's actually on so these are all building blocks. And so really what you have to have, for the most part, is just enough of them around that your body can convert them into what it needs to. So it's more of a thresholding thing. It is possible to be hyperthyroidal, but you have to have a lot extra to become hyperthyroidal. Mm. And I mean, the total mass of these things is very small. I mean, all the tumors is much smaller than the original thyroid was. So, you know, it's a fairly insignificant amount that it's adding.
But it's significant enough that it'll kill you?
No. What kills you is, as I said, is that it'll either be the brain, and that it actually, you know, grows into parts of the brain and destroys function of the brain because it's actually just, you know,
right,
compressing the brain and
right,
shutting off, you know, and stealing vascularization from the brain. That's one of the big things that the cancer does, is that, you know, these cells have no vascularization. I mean, there's no arteries going to them or anything. So what happens in the genetic modification is they're able to glom onto something and then they steal the nutrients from that thing. And so the parasitic part of it is actually what kills you. In that case, or the other case is bone failure, which then they just keep growing in the bones and break the bones, and then, you know, spine collapses.
So what are you gonna do? What do you think? I'm sure you've pictured this. Once the final thing looks like it's not working, and the doctors are sort of like shrugging their shoulders and looking around at each other, what are you gonna do then? Let's stop to take a quick break. We'll be right back. What are you going to do then?
I don't know. I really don't. It's one of the major differences in the way I live my life now versus pre-cancer is literally I can't predict anything more than 90 days out. And my brain actually just doesn't engage in that kind of behavior anymore. It's just when I think about something 90, you know, 6 months out, it's just a gray wall. Because so many times through a change in medication or something not working, you know, I don't know from month to month how I'm going to feel.
So I wonder if this is applicable at all in let's say normal, quote unquote, normal life. Is that, you know, none of us really know 6 months out what's going to happen. And yet we do have to, like, I have to plan 6 months out. I have to plan a year out. I have kids growing up and stuff like that. I guess I have to think about it, but maybe there's a way I think about it with too much anxiety sometimes, or I don't know. I'm wondering,
I think,
pick apart this for my lessons, but...
No, I think that's great. I think if you're really honest with yourself and you look back over your life, you'll probably realize that your 1 year, 5 year, and 10 year plan was almost never more than 10% accurate.
Right, or less, much less.
Exactly. And so at a certain level...
I could never have predicted just about anything.
Exactly. So it's just negative emotional masturbation. Mm. Like, it's just you masturbate and feel worse at the end because you imagined everything that was horrible, and then you know that it's probably not going to work because you know you don't know, And so you just spend all this time and energy and you just don't know. And you make the decision. So, you know, you make the decisions on the fly. I like to talk about the metaphor of, or think about the metaphor of going west. And so I don't know if I ever mentioned this to you before, but, you know, there was the, of course, the saying, go west, young men, for fortune lie. I always think that, like, the people in New York City, when they were thinking about going west, I mean, they didn't have flights. They had no idea what west was. They didn't have color photographs. And so they're like, oh, the streets are paved with gold, virgins everywhere, you know, whatever they said. But they had this vision of what west is. And they really, all they really knew about west is that it wasn't north, south, or east. And so they just got in their wagons and they started heading west. And some of them got to like St. Louis and saw the, you know, the river and they're like, oh, this is perfect. This is what west looks like. I love this. I'm going to stay here. And, you know, some went to Kansas and they're like, oh, fields, west. I love west. And some got to Montana. I'm like, no, mountains, that's west. And some got to California. Like, there's nothing else to do. So this must be west. But, you know, what the thing that they had was they had a direction. And I think the direction's hugely important. But the notion that you can plan for what are you going to do in the West when you're in New York City is just absurd. You'll never know what West is. You can only recognize West once you get West. And so for you, like, I've known you long enough to know that, like, taking care of your kids is hugely important. Mm-hmm. And so the, having the focus of, is this going to get me closer to taking care of my kids or not? That's a really important question.
Or I guess also, it heightens, the, like you said earlier, it heightens the importance of these relationships. So I might not call my kids today, for instance, but no, but heightening it just a little, I will call my kids today. So the direction sort of intensifies a little bit.
Yes,
I think, and I think what is applicable is intensifying those directions because we really don't know. I mean, you might know, and so that's intensified this direction for you of relationships, but I think it's important to always intensify them. You can't say, oh, this Friday I'm going to do something I don't want to do because I always have next Friday.
Right.
You know, better to intensify every moment. And then there's that cliche, like live life like it's your last. I'm not sure that's a good cliche either because that could be taken in a lot of different ways. But let's just take it in this way. You know, in a positive way, you should almost live life like today's your last Friday or...
Yeah, no... Excuse me, I totally agree with that. I think there's two things there is that if you really live today like it's your last, you end up mortgaging your future. You know, you make decisions. You know, if I really thought I was going to die tomorrow, I would just go immediately max out my credit card. I don't know what I would do, but I mean, like literally, if I thought I was dying tomorrow, I would go out and have very reckless behavior in the next 24 hours.
Right.
And then to your point, when it turns out I probably don't die tomorrow, then tomorrow I'd be like, oh man, that's gonna suck. And now I have to deal with the ramifications of that. And so, you know, I really believe in not mortgaging your present for the future and not mortgaging your future for the present, because all we really know that we have is today. But if I'm really present today, then, you know, you can't go out and do something that you know will harm your children 10 years from now and be happy about it today.
Right.
And so if you're really present to what today, what you want today, today you do want your kids to be happy 10 years in the future. And so that allows you to balance that out a little bit, you know, but focusing on, oh my God, 10 years in the future, what's going to happen? You have no idea. And I have no idea.
So let's say, I mean, you've been under the gun with this almost literally for these 3 years and thank God all these different drugs have worked and now you're in this new drug protocol and then hopefully there'll be a new one discovered. This is a weird question, and we've talked about it in this past, but at some point, do you want it to be over? Like, do you think there'll ever be a point where, let's say they find a drug that, okay, this one might last 48 months for you. Would that be a little bit of a drag? That's a long time now.
No, it's an interesting question, and I don't know, there's no easy answer to it.
Because the obvious answer is, of course, you want to live as long as possible, but is there some nuance
there? Well, so
there?
Like when I was on, I mean, and the answer is it depends. Mm. When I was on the last medication at the peak dose, you know, when I had the greatest side effects, I was just like, I can't do this.
What were some of the side effects?
Tremendous nausea, tremendous fatigue. Couldn't eat anything. I was losing a huge amount of weight. Everything tasted bad. As I said, I was too tired. When people came over, I couldn't pay attention. I was just constantly uncomfortable. Lots of cramping too. That's actually one of the, I still have some cramping, but that's, I don't really understand why, but you just get these like wake up in the middle of the night, just in excruciating pain for an hour, and there's just nothing you can do about it.
Where?
Generally in the legs, but it could be anywhere. And so, you know, and I don't have that level of pain right now, but when that was going on, I mean, you know, it's like, if this is the rest of the life, then there's just no point to doing this. And then at the second level of dose, it was very much like, you know, I don't know. I mean, like, I don't know. At some point I may just decide to stop doing this. It wasn't like I felt like I had to, but, you know, there's that sense that, you know, if you believe, I mean, it's an interesting thing. So like, so I have to digress for just one second is that, you know, having a really short fuse is unbelievably easy. And like so much stuff that you worry about just goes away. You know, like you're asking like dating, like, well, you know, you can't have a really serious relationship in 6 months. And so if you're going to be dead in 6 months, you don't worry like, oh, am I ever going to get married? You don't even think about it. You're just like, nope, not going to do that. You know, and so there's so much stuff that I don't have to worry about. And I'm very thankful for that in a lot of ways. And, you know, starting about a year ago and even now, you know, a year later, they keep extending the timeline. And so like my fuse keeps getting longer and longer. And it's harder and harder not to get anxious about stuff. And so, you know, I have that anxiety developing a little bit these days. I still largely fight through it because it's still enough stuff to remind me that, you know, that I'm sick and that I have a short fuse that I can't forget it. But it's also really easy for me to be like, oh man, if I last 3 years, you know, crap, I might run out of money. What am I going to do then? Mm-hmm. And then I think, you know, who cares? I mean, you know, celebrate because I, you know, it's only good news if I run out of money. Mm-hmm. I feel like I didn't answer your question.
No, that does.
And so, you know, but do I want, yeah, at least once a week, there's a moment when I just think, it'll be nice when this is finally over.
And I mean, part of that is, do you get depressed if there's news of a new drug that could extend?
I get anxious. I don't get depressed. I get anxious, you know.
Because like the money, the relationships, or will the drug work or not? Like what part makes you anxious?
Future.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is totally cliche, you know, but like, you know, I mean, like, so the summer was interesting because this summer there were a couple of different choices that I had to potentially make. And there was a lot of test results coming out. And at the beginning, at one point they were considering putting me on a stage one trial. And these are the riskiest of trials. And there's a good chance they completely don't work. Stage one is mainly designed to test toxicity and does the drug work at all? Mm. Not how well does it work, just like, does it even do anything and will it kill you? But of course the stage one drug is the early, you know, that's the magic bullet that you're hunting for too. So you don't really want to do a stage one trial. But the thing is that I couldn't do a stage. I mean, after this drug, I probably don't qualify for any stage one trials because after two of the drugs, now I'm not a clean sample. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the summer was like, do a stage one now or never do it. And if I do the stage one, then it takes about 4 months to discover it doesn't work if it doesn't work. And in 4 months, my brain metastasis grows so fast when I'm unmedicated that in 4 months that could do really significant damage, or it could actually be phenomenal. Now, ultimately, the doctors decided that they actually just wouldn't even let me do it because they thought it was too risky. But at one point, you know, I'm looking at these things. I'm trying to decide, you know, do I try to go for the magic bullet? You know, with the knowledge that it could really significantly impact me.
Would you call the research scientist who made the drug and ask like for his what's his philosophy behind how he made the drug?
Interestingly enough, I wouldn't, but a good friend of mine worked in the technical part of cancer research and knows a lot of the teams, and he was like, I'm gonna call. He's like, as soon as they tell you the drug names, I'll call the teams and find out what they think about it.
Mm.
But you know, so like when you, so, you know, I'm very mathy. I'm very kind of geeky in the way I think about stuff. And so, you know, in August, even when we decide not to do the clinical trial, we've got, you know, two drugs, one with a 60% chance of working and one with a 50% chance of working. And so what I know is that, you know, if we make a 2x2 quadrant, there's a 30% chance neither drug works. And so in August, I'm aware that there's a 1 in 3 chance that I've got about 4 to 6 months of high quality life left. And, you know, what sort of plans can I make when I don't know that? And, like, and if I don't, you know, if it doesn't work at all, you know, I'm just a few months away from, you know, physical surgeries, potential massive, like potentially in a wheelchair, potentially in a hospital bed. And so, like, there's no ability for your brain to even think about, you know, what would I do? Mm-hmm. Now, fortunately, I'm in the, you know, right now the good half quadrant. So we've definitely pushed that off, you know, a 1, 2, 2.5 years, however long we've pushed it off. We pushed that off for a while. But so it's really difficult to make plans when it's so dynamic, the volatility of, you know, literally, I mean, even as I'm saying this, I know that there's about a 20% chance that in 2 weeks I'll be told that that it's not working in the brain. Mm-hmm. And then that takes us down a totally different fork.
And so there's all these, there's kind of these periods of like, no news is good news. And then there's suddenly these periods of like serious decision making where you have to like build these quadrants and figure out these odds and so on.
Yeah.
And that changes everything.
Well, it's not even so much that there's that much decision making, is there's just that much outcome variability. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's not a lot of decisions most of the time. The doctors are like, we'd like for you to do this if that's okay. And then you're like, well, what happens if I don't? And then they're like, your brain will explode. And you're like, okay, I guess I'll do what you said then. And that sounds like a...
Yeah, brain exploding doesn't sound good.
They didn't actually say that, but, you know.
So in the U.S. is the best, what I always think of as the best cancer centers in the world, which is Sloan Kettering and MD Anderson, but is that not true?
Three best cancer centers in the world, hands down, Sloan Kettering, MD Anderson, and Institut Gustave Roussy in Paris.
I see. So that's the one you go to.
That's the one I go to. Uh-huh. The difference is my total out-of-pocket costs per year range generally about 100 to 150 euros per year. So less than 200 bucks a year.
Wow.
For some reason, I don't know why, the French government will not pay for magnesium pills. And so I have to buy I take magnesium twice a day.
For what?
That's actually part of the cramping we were talking about
before. You know what? I've been told magnesium's good for cramping because I get sometimes cramps.
And magnesium is great for cramping.
Why is that? I
have no idea, but I literally, if I take no magnesium, I will not be able to walk. I will be in pain, you know, tons of times. Like I'll laugh and then a muscle in my rib cage will freeze up and then I can't, you know, it's in like inside the rib cage, so I can't stretch it. It's excruciating. I take two of the slow-release magnesium pills per day, and now it's very small and very manageable.
How many pills a day do you take overall?
20-ish.
20-ish?
Yeah.
And do you take any painkillers?
Not now. I've taken a lot of painkillers. I have all the good painkillers, but...
Why didn't you drop them off last time we saw each other?
You know, you hadn't bought me dinner yet. We'll see now that you've bought me dinner.
So, Mike, your party's going to be in January.
The party's going to be in January.
What day?
January 9th to 14th.
Mm. All right, maybe I should go over to France.
Definitely go over to France.
I haven't been to France in, I don't know, I guess close to 20 years.
I mean, it's a little way, it's far away from 79th Street. But
I know, I'm going to have to leave my block. I don't usually leave my block. I'm afraid of that now. But, you know, Mike, thanks for coming on and sharing all this stuff. And, of course... It's obvious, but good luck on whatever counts for luck from this point.
Yeah.
What is good luck for you right now? Presumably that it doesn't go to the brain. That's the first piece of good luck.
I honestly, James, don't care what happens mm-hmm. on that front. It's the ride. You know, it's something that I find hard to explain to people, but I'm completely at peace with the fact that I die. And I actually, you know, going back to something you were saying before is that I wish other people were at peace with the fact that they're going to die mm-hmm. because I really think that knowing that and even quantifying it a little bit is makes you make better decisions. I think it makes you live a better life.
I think that's really true. And also I think it's really hard to think that way because the brain, look, that's why... It's almost a Darwinistic thing, is the people who didn't think that way lived and had kids. And, you know, if somebody thought always like, oh, I'm not going to live, so I'm not going to have kids, that group of humans
I don't mean that. Like, I don't think, you know, think about your death imminently. Uh-huh. But like, you know, you mentioned a couple of times the number, you know, you live 2,500 weeks.
Right.
You know, statistically, you've got about 2,000 of them left. Uh-huh. And you're probably going to work 1,800 of them or so, maybe 1,600 of them. And you know, I've mentioned this to you before, but like, if you only had $2,000 in the bank, you would be totally cognizant of everything that you spent the money on. But almost everyone will just be like, ugh, I don't know, this boyfriend, this girlfriend, ugh, I'll deal with it next month. And right. It's like you just spent 4 more weeks that you will never, ever get back. You know, how long did we both stay at HBO? Maybe I shouldn't say that on air, but how much did you stay there loathing it?
And you a lot longer than me.
Yeah, well, you were smart. You got out. And but you hated it for a long time, too.
Yeah.
You were just scheming to get out faster.
Right, right. Scheming is the right word.
You had a much better exit strategy than I did. I just waited until I got fired. Mm. You waited until you made a lot of money. Mm. But I mean, it's like how long will we wait? You know, it's like how many Friday nights will we stay at home until we realize we don't have any more Friday nights? You know, and that's the thing. It's not that I think life has tremendous meaning and tremendous opportunity. And it's we make decisions out of fear because we're afraid of something that there's no reason to be afraid of. You know, like when you think about what actually happens, that's going to happen. Like you're going to die. What the hell are you afraid of? You know, it doesn't really. And so I think that, I don't know. I think that if you just recognize how precious the time that you have on life, on the planet is, you just live a better life. And yeah. it's the opposite of nihilism. It's like this is again, huge cliche, but I really feel it. Every day is a gift. And I'm very aware that at any given moment, there are an infinite number of things I could be doing other than this. And so, you know, there's a bunch of things I could have done before other than this podcast, but the podcast is what I wanted to do the most. And so I chose to do that because that's what I'm going to spend my time doing is the things that are important to me.
Well, I'm super grateful you are doing the podcast. What are you doing the rest of today?
I actually don't know yet. to that point, I've actually got some plans that I'm like, I don't really know if I want to do those plans. So we'll see what I end up doing. Maybe I'm having coffee with you. I don't know.
Yeah, that could be. All right. Well, Mike Van Cleave, I don't know what to say. thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to my conversation with Mike. It was a really important podcast for me for a lot of reasons, but I hope in some ways you benefit from it, learn something from it, and that it's just as meaningful for you in your own way as it is for me. Mike and I also talk about the science of cancer, his medical treatments, the drugs they're testing, and all the advances they're trying to make in medicine to help people suffering from thyroid cancer. You can keep listening now to hear that conversation and learn more about the science and the biology of thyroid cancer. It's not just about thyroid cancer, but all types of cancer. I really recommend it. And if you like this show, I hope you'll subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. When you subscribe, it helps other people find the show more easily. Thanks a lot.
There's a treatment. It's very technical and not that interesting. Thyroid is the only tissue in the body which retains iodine. And so they can then target radioactive particles to the thyroid cancer. And 1% of the situations, the thyroid morphs enough to where it no longer absorbs iodine. And so if you were in that 1%, and you know, I always like to be in the top 1%.
you're a success.
I'm huge, yeah, yeah.
You're a 1%er,
man. I'm a 1%er. I don't mean to brag, but I'm in the 1%.
Yeah.
So anyway, if you have that, then that treatment no longer works, and then you're just a normal cancer. And so then you have back the untreatable stuff. And that was about 3 years ago, almost exactly 3 years ago. They told me that it was now called iodine refractory. And so when that happened, I knew that there was only about a 14-month window on average.
So 3 months ago.
No, 3 years ago.
3 years ago, sorry. 3 years ago. So 7.5 years ago, thyroid cancer. cured it, somewhat cured it.
Yeah.
But then 3 years ago, what happened? Were you feeling like pain somewhere?
No, it was, in fact, it was a regular checkup. It was a regular checkup, and it was the last checkup until they said, you're in remission, you're good to go. And they were already saying stuff like, don't worry, this is not going to kill you. You're going to die of something else. And so it was the very last test. And then they did that test in August, and there was a tiny bit of progression. And they thought it was coming from a lymph node, which had a slight amount of metastasis at the, you know, 3.5 years earlier.
So just because I'm totally naive about all this, when they say a tiny bit of progression, they're seeing some cells that are kind of look odd. They're mutating, so they don't look like different. They don't look like the other cells in the area.
Kind of. All right. So I mean, it's you know, it's funny because I know a lot about this subject, obviously, and I could spend the entire podcast just talking about that, and I'd be mostly wrong because I'm not a doctor, but you know, I understand it well enough.
Doctors are probably mostly wrong anyway. So.
Probably, yeah. They took my thyroid out, and so I have no thyroid. The cancer
cells. Which thyroid is like kind of one of those things like the appendix, sort of semi-useless or no?
No, completely useful. The thyroid creates hormones that are then used to create other hormones. And so all the hormones, a lot of the chemicals in your body are produced from the building blocks the thyroid makes. Now, the good news is you can just take thyroid hormones every day and then you're totally fine. And so it's a very manageable thing, yeah.
And the body doesn't then get used to those drugs or stops making the hormones?
I don't have a thyroid, so I can't make the hormone.
Right, so with the drugs, you have to take more and more or like?
No. It's just you have to have a certain amount of the thyroid hormones. They're called, the thyroid creates three hormones, T1, 2, and 3. So T1, T2, T3. And you need T1 and T3, and so you take it in pill form. And then
if you didn't take those drugs, what would happen?
Die in about a year and a half, or something like that.
Because
basically, I don't really even know, but you know, all sorts of like important things in your body would just slowly cease to function because they wouldn't have the necessary. You know, like you wouldn't have any testosterone, you wouldn't have, I think, estrogen, but I'm not sure. But there's a whole bunch of stuff that is. Like the pituitary gland, if I understand correctly, takes the T1 and T3 and turns it into other useful things. And okay. So eventually you would
bad things happen.
Bad things happen, yeah.
So some progression has happened. Something's leaked out of the thyroid.
So what happens is at this stage, nothing is visible on the CT scan. And so they don't know anything other than I take T1 and T3. It's a very common medicine. I actually can't remember the name of it all of a sudden. It's surprisingly nerve-wracking to have a microphone sitting in front of you
while talking about your death sentence.
Well, that doesn't bother me. You know, it's my favorite subject almost. It's me. There's a byproduct in the thyroid called thyroglobulin. When it's making these hormones, it has a leftover thing called thyroglobulin, and they can measure the thyroglobulin in your body. And since I don't have a thyroid, I should have no thyroglobulin in my body. And so that thyroglobulin is the marker for is there, you know, rogue thyroid cells.
So like something slipped out when they removed the cancer from the thyroid. When they removed your thyroid, something that potentially had cancer on it slipped out.
You could look at it that way. I mean, what it really is that little thyroid cells broke off of the cancer, and then they swam around in my body until they found a place where they could land. The first one was in my lung. And so then the thyroid started growing inside of the lung. So I have a little tiny thyroid in my lung.
So does that mean then, so what's that called?
That's metastasis.
And so is that like related, or does that mean you have like a little bit of lung cancer, or is it just?
No, I have thyroid cancer in the lung. So I don't have lung cancer.
Right.
So a cancer means it's the original cells that have mutated and they're now capable of going somewhere else.
So they see a tiny bit. What's a tiny bit? Like a millimeter worth or?
I think the lung is 4 millimeters now. I can't even count them anymore. I think I have 17 bone metastases. The largest of those is about the size of a golf ball, or was about the size
Where's
of
that?
A golf ball. That was in my lower back, in one of my vertebrae.
And did you feel that?
Yes.
So that must have been painful.
That is painful, yeah. So bone, I mean, the thyroid in the bones, you know, your bones have the hard fibrous tissue, and then they have the marrow inside of it. And the marrow, of course, is where all the blood gets filtered and stuff. So it's a really great place for a cancer to take up home because it's so rich in nutrients inside of the marrow. Mm. And so what happens is that you start developing a thyroid inside of the bone, and as the thyroid grows, it breaks the bone from the inside. Mm. And so now most of my bones haven't broken, but they started cracking in the lower vertebra in the back. And so I've had surgeries on three of the vertebra where they, which is really amazing. They take a needle, thick, it's like a knitting needle, and they put it in and they inject some sort of gas, like liquid nitrogen, but it's not liquid nitrogen, but it's inert, and it freezes the tumor, so it kills everything in that little ice ball. And they can make the ice ball about a quarter of an inch to about 3/4 of an inch, and just kills all the tissue inside of there. And then they go in and they inject bone cement, which is basically just a epoxy inside of there, and fill the cavity up. And so now those are just as strong as they were before. The procedure.
And so you have this session where it's almost, you're almost free and clear from the old cancer. You suddenly realize you have new cancer. Does the doctor say, uh-oh, like what does the doctor say?
Well,
just to be clear, like at that point, when you came out of that doctor's office, were you given like, okay, most people in your situation have, you know, like you say, 14 months to live, or like what's the full amount of information you have at the end of that session?
Well, it evolves over a period of time. Mm-hmm. It is, there's a funny anecdote around that as well.
So, well, we want funny anecdotes.
Exactly.
Around
So when they first discover that there's elevated thyroglobulin count, what they do is, and this is how thyroid cancer is normally treated if it's radioactive. I mean, if it'll still absorb iodine. Is you go into a hospital room for 3 days, they give you a tiny little radioactive iodine pill that's about the size of a baby aspirin. And then that, because the iodine is only absorbed by thyroid tissue, and radiation poisoning is a function of duration, distance, and power, they give you an incredibly low dosage of radiation. It swims around your bloodstream, and then when it finds thyroid tissue, it embeds in there. And so now you have, you know, close proximity for long durations, but the rest of your organs, it just passes by, and so they get almost no radiation poisoning. And so that's how it like systematically, you know, kills everything. But now you're radioactive for a few days. And so the when they did the scan after that, they do, I can't remember the name of the scan, but it's a scan where it's like a CT scan, but they're not bombarding me with radiation. They just run the sensors around me because I'm radioactive. And so then they can see wherever there's clumps, you know, of the thyroid cells glowing. And what they could see is that there was partial response in some of the thyroid cells. And so they could see the cancer cells. They could see the cancer cell, and they could see that not all of it had absorbed the radiation, which means that it was no longer absorbing. And then they did more tests eventually and saw that there were other sites which had cancer in them but did not pick up the iodine at all.
So if from that point you had not done any treatment, how long would you have survived?
3 to 6 months, probably.
3 to 6 months. Now it's 3 years later. So what happened? It's three years later.
I got to tell you the funny anecdote part.
Oh,
though.
Yeah, tell me, of course. We can't miss the humor.
And so I'm on the table getting the scan, and I'm really expecting this to be nothing. Like I'm 3 years into it, you know, one thing away from it. And they do the scan, and then I go in the waiting room. This is usual. And they come back like, Mr. Van Cleave. And of course, this is in France, so it's all in French. The technicians don't speak English very well. And my French is good, but you know, it's still a little confusing because medical terminology is medical terminology. And they're like, we one of the pictures didn't quite come out clearly. Can we just get you to come back on the table for a few minutes? And it's like, yeah, sure, no problem. I'll go back on the table. Didn't really think anything about it. And then they go back on the table, and then they're like, okay, go back, and you know, we'll send you home in a few moments. And I go back out, and about a half hour later, they're like, actually, we're really just having problems getting a good image of this one area. You know, could you come back? And I was like, okay. And then I start noticing that like other doctors are coming in, and like there's a little bit of commotion behind the, you know, in the control room. And I was like, oh, this can't be good. And then it turns out they were looking at a metastasis in my, I think it was in my hip, but it was in the lower part of my body. But I knew that the testes was one of the places where, you know, it might metastasize to. Actually, I don't even know if that's true, but I believed it strongly at the time. And all of a sudden I was like, oh my God, they're taking pictures of the little guys. Like, oh my God, I have metastasis and it's in the little guys. And the first thing I thought of is I have three of my friends in Paris who were young women, no sexual relationship with them whatsoever. But the first thing I thought of was, got to get to a sperm bank so that if they want to have, use my sperm, they can get knocked up. And so like the very first thing that occurred to me
was altruistic.
Was totally altruistic. But I was just like, how do I knock up my hot friends? That was the first thought that I had. And then I was like, that's a really weird thing to think about, because this is clearly, you know, a more significant thing than knocking up hot friends. But
also, I don't know the genetics of your cancer, but maybe they might not want to be knocked up by your...
You know, well, that's a whole nother story. I think genetics of cancer, just my own genetics, maybe, you know, maybe the question.
Do you think the kind of cancer you have is genetic?
They actually don't know, but probably not.
So do you have any reason why you would get it, or is it sort of random? Or
it is completely random. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. They really don't know. There's a dramatic upswing in thyroid cancers in the U.S. And worldwide, and they're not sure why. The only known risk factors of thyroid cancer are literally things like people who live near, I can't think of the name of that Soviet...
Like Chernobyl?
Chernobyl, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like, did you live near Chernobyl? Were you in Hiroshima? Like, these are the only risk factors of thyroid cancer. But there's been, I think, a 20% increase in the last 20 years of thyroid cancer. So they don't know.
So you would wonder, do people in Utah or Nevada have like high risk of thyroid cancer?
Well, just the whole population's getting thyroid cancer more frequently than they used to. But there's still no known risk factors for it other than proximity to radiation.
So you finally come back and realize it's not your testes.
Right, it's not the little guys. And so then, you know, in answer to your question, there's a whole bunch of scans. You know, they do the CT scan, then they do a PET scan. And then the first thing that I really got from the doctor was, and actually still if I ask the doctor this question, they always just say, don't know. Mm-hmm. Impossible to predict on an individual basis. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, you and I have talked a lot about poker, same sort of thing. You know, we know that 1 in 5 times your aces gets cracked. I have no idea whether your aces are going to get cracked this time. Mm-hmm. And so the doctors really just are very careful not to set expectations. Now, my doctors either love or hate me because I read all the medical journals. I never, ever, and by the way, anyone who's sick, I recommend you do not read patient sites for cancer, because it'll just terrify you. Mm. But the medical journals, you know, will tell you what the current state of the art of thinking is. And so anyway, I went in and I was like, so what does this mean? And she's like, well, it's really hard to say, blah, blah, blah. And so then I was like, well, as I understood it, you know, I read the whatever journal it was, and it said this, 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 and this. And that seems like, you know, not a very good, you know, situation. And she kind of hemmed and hawed, and I repeated it. And she said, I don't really know what you want me to say. You understand the situation perfectly accurately. And that was kind of the most confirmation.
Confirmation of what?
That what I knew was correct, that it was a 9 to 12 month, you know, kind of outside period.
And just to be clear, because we didn't set the stage in the beginning, you have cancer right now.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it hasn't... Is it? Would you say it's worse now than it was then? I mean, as much as you've tried to control it?
Oh, no, it's significantly worse now. It's significantly more controlled now. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, so the thing is, there are, at the time of this, there were two drugs approved in Europe for the treatment of the cancer. And now there's three.
And is it better in Europe or to be in U.S.?
It really doesn't matter for the most part.
Because the same drugs were in the U.S.?
Same drugs are worldwide. Mm-hmm. The FDA and the EMA may approve things at different rates. So, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes something's available in Europe, it's not available in the States and vice versa. But if it's an effective treatment within 6 months to a year, it's available, you know, everywhere. So it's mm-hmm. just a matter of the bureaucracy timing. And, you know, contrary to, I think, a lot of belief, the FDA and the EMA are both very efficient and both do it at about the same time. But there's just kind of some randomness in terms of, you know, how long it takes to get something through.
So you went through a bunch of different drug protocols. Each one lasts how long?
Well, so the first one that I took was pazopanib. And pazopanib, on average, it works for 50% of the people on average for 12 months.
So you were in the good. You were in the good 50%.
I was in the good 50%.
And 12 months later, they started seeing it was not working as well.
I was extremely lucky very fortunate in that I didn't start showing symptoms of growth for 24 months.
Oh, okay.
And then I was able to stay on it for about another 4 months while they figured out what the next treatment was. So I actually got a useful 28 months out of that. And so that's 2.5 times what they expected me to have out of that.
And so that's incredible. How often does that happen?
Probably just a few percent. I mean, it's a fairly long tail out there. Each standard deviation is about 3 months.
So that would have taken you close to like a year ago, right? So
I just switched cancer medications about 2 months ago.
Okay, and so how's that going so far? And how long is this one supposed to work? And by the way, to be clear, I from what I understand, these cancer drugs eliminate, let's say, 90% of the cancer, but meanwhile, the other 10% is growing, and that's why you suddenly then need a new cancer drug.
Yeah, it's actually more effective than that if they work. I mean, they may not work at all. Mm-hmm. And for like 50% of the people, it just has no effect. Mm-hmm. And then for the people that it works, it probably is, because there's literally, hundreds of millions, if not billions of cancer cells, because you just have a lot of cells in your body. Mm-hmm. And so it works in like 99.9% of them. But as you said, over time, that 1% that it doesn't work in keeps having and growing and growing. And eventually there's more of those than there are of the ones that it works in. And so eventually you develop what's called resistance, but it's really not resistant. It's just actually the
right,
cells.
It's not that, standard. It's not like antibiotic resistance.
No.
Where your body gets used to it.
No.
It's just like the cells that never were affected have continued to sort of replicate
exactly.
themselves, and now they're the cancer in your body.
Exactly.
And they've replaced the old cancer cells in your body.
That's
mostly.
Exactly correct.
So then 2 months ago, they started you on a new drug that I guess was straight out of trials or straight out of experiments. And how is that going?
So far, we think very good. I'm actually just at almost 2 months. On Friday, it'll be on 2 months. So that's why I have to go back to Paris to have some tests on Friday. And in the first 2 months, we've seen a 50% reduction in the thyroglobulin, which is the cancer marker I was describing before. So this means there's a 50% reduction in cancer activity, which means the cancer cells, the total number of cancer cells have to have shrunk by 50%.
And could this drug work forever?
No.
So what's the likely pathway of this drug?
This drug is about 18 months for quote unquote working. And working is defined that the cancer is shrinking. Which is not, and now there's another one metric called progression-free survival, which means that your cancer is stable. Now for me, at the moment, as you can tell, I don't really have any side effects. Mm. All the side effects I have are side effects of the medication. Mm. And so stability is great for me. Mm. Even though I have brain metastasis, they haven't affected anything. And so we don't really
care. As far as we know.
I'm as dopey as I ever was.
Right.
And so,
have you noticed anything like some memory blackout?
No, humor
issue. Or
I haven't, but honestly,
anger.
Anytime I like misplace my keys, I'm like, oh my god, I'm having my brain's exploding. Uh-huh. I can blame the illness for lots of stuff. That then 2 days later, I have I'm just like, no, that was just stupid. There was nothing to do with that. There's a lot of that kind of stuff.
This drug,
and
18
so right
months.
Now the will be tested in November 29th, and that'll be the first PET scan I've had, and that will tell us where it's working in the body. So the real question now is, we know that we have a reduction in tumor mass, and the medication is most likely to work in soft tissue. Then it's most likely to work in bone, and it's least likely to work in brain. And now I had a lot of bone pain by the end of the summer as the last medication quit being effective. And I have no bone pain right now. So there's a very good chance that all the bone metastasis is working. So that really takes about 80% of the badness off the table. We still don't know whether it'll work in the brain because of the brain blood barrier. And so we'll find that out on November 29th.
And what happens in 18 months?
Well, in 18 months.
Or 16 now.
Or you know, whenever it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so. And by the way, that's the median. And so, you know, if half the people last less, half the people last more. Mm-hmm. What'll happen is at some point, the cancer will just start growing again. And now it's not like when you develop resistance, as you can imagine, even though it is a logarithmic or exponential function, since it's dividing, it still takes a long time to overwhelm. And so it's not like a light switch or something. Just
because
slowly.
It starts small and it's got to build.
Exactly.
It's like one grain of rice on the first piece, you know, set two grains of rice before. But then 20 later, it's huge.
Exactly. So. Exactly. It's like mold in your refrigerator. Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden you're just like, what the hell happened? It's only been a week. But for a long time.
I'm not eating dinner at your apartment.
You should not. You should not. No. So. I don't really cook anymore. But actually, my apartment's just filled with cheese. So that's mold anyway. So
I didn't know that. So, okay. So whenever this drug stops to work, what happens next?
Then there's one more drug, which is approved right now, and that's that drug only works on average for 50% of the people and on average for 6 months. And so
that's why they haven't used it with you yet, because it's sort of like the least.
It's the worst drug. Yeah. It's the least effective in thyroid cancer, and it's also the least effective in suppression. So the one I'm on right now is awesome. Now, there's a caveat in there. Is that there is a clinical trial which is scheduled to start soon in the U.S. France, the hospital I go to, is enrolled in that trial as well. And so there's a good chance by the time this would quit working that I could get into that trial. And that trial is to use this medication plus a biologic agent, which is a different type of treatment. And that treatment is very experimental, but they've shown about an additional 6 months in the early stage trials with this biological.
What's a biological agent?
So the therapy that I currently have, and if you remember, I talked about it last year, it's complicated, but it's called small molecular therapy. And so they can, every cell in your body is made up of a certain number of proteins, and they can mathematically model what the shape of the vascularization port is. And so your cells have a hole in the middle of them, which blood goes into, and then you get the osmosis of the nutrients and the oxygen and all that stuff. The small molecule therapy is they actually design a non-soluble molecule that plugs up that port. And so it's just literally like they're just putting corks in all of these cancer cells and they just die of starvation. And that's actually how this medication works.
Well, that's fascinating. They even invented that.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's you know, subvisible. And so it's all done through mathematical modeling of the likelihood. Because they know, so my particular one is called...
Can they ever make like, I don't know, cell robots the size of cells that just go through and like find all the cells and... patch them up?
I mean, that's you know, that's the science fiction, you know, the nanotech stuff. I don't know that, you know, they're never close to doing something like that. And so anyway, so the small molecular therapy, there's only, and I don't remember the exact number, I think it's around 40, 45 proteins in your body that are used to create every cell in your body. And then a subset of those, and I think that number is around 10 or 13, 10 to 15, are called the kinase proteins. And the kinase proteins are used in like really high growth applications, like making hair or skin pigmentation, and also fingernails and cancer, because the cancer is really fast growing. So there's a lot of kinase proteins inside of the cancer. And so what they can do is take these proteins and then figure out what the shape. Because they're like Legos. I mean, the proteins are always the same shape. And so they mathematically figure out what could the shape of that port be once you combine those proteins. And so then they try to plug that up. And so each of these three medications is just a slightly different shaped non-soluble molecule. And since they can't block 100% of the ports, then again, as we just said, the 1% or the 0.5% or whatever that's not blocked eventually overwhelms it. And then you try the next drug and try to block that up.
So let's look at like a best case scenario.
Right.
So 16 months is the median of the drug you're currently on.
Yeah.
So let's just say 24, 30, 32 months.
24, yeah, probably.
24 months is the possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And then this next trial is 6 months, but that's like a median. So let's say 12 months. So then you're looking at like 36 months And then you're going to really hope that there's another drug that's in trials or something that we don't even know exists yet.
Right.
And so otherwise, you're looking at a maximum of 3 years.
That's about right, yeah.
And what happens then? Like, your cancer will be spreading. There's no way to stop it. Can they go back to old drugs and see if those work?
No. I mean, really, honestly, really bad things happen. They will revert to surgical procedures.
To kind of scrape out cells that look bad?
Yeah. I mean, so as I said, in this current drug, about 80% of the really bad is off the table. If there is no efficacy in the brain, they'll keep doing radiation treatments. And they do these three-dimensional radiation treatments where they have a couple lasers that rotate around your head and shoot radiation beams in your head. And they can target an area as small as 2 millimeters. Mm-hmm. And so they can really precisely place that. And because they're going around your head in a circle and they never cross the same path, it's a little bit like, you know, a bicycle wheel. You can't see the outer spokes because they've moved so fast, but at the hub, it looks like it's standing still. So they concentrate all the energy that way. So there's very little radiation on the side. So they'll start doing that, and that's very effective. But at a certain point, you reach the maximum amount of radiation the brain can have, and then the brain just starts developing other sorts of radiation-related problems.
Like what?
It's radionecrosis. And so wherever these laser beams go, you have dead tissue in your body. Mm. That dead tissue can become infected.
And so how long can you do these radiation treatments on the brain?
I don't even know. I mean, I know there's no direct answer. It depends on the total duration and power of the radiation beams. Hmm. So I can't remember. I think microcuries is the unit of measurement. I shouldn't even say that. I have no idea what the unit of measurement is. But I know that the number is around like 100, and you can't have more than 100 units until you'll develop leukemia or some sort of other hideous thing. So they'll start with the radiation treatment, then they'll finally go to surgical procedures where they actually just go in and cut out the cancer cells. But eventually it just becomes whack-a-mole because it develops very fast. Mm. And so then, you know, there's kind of two choices for me. Both are really unpleasant. I'll either have massive brain failure or I will have spinal failure. And that really just means that my spine will break into pieces and I'll become paralyzed and eventually the, you know, organs and stuff will shut down because it'll kill the nerves. Mm. And so I'll die that way.
So that's all fun.
Good morning.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network at jamesaltucher.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening today. I'm really happy with this podcast today. If you like this interview, I know you'll like so many more. You can be the first to hear all my new episodes by subscribing now on Apple Podcasts or whatever app you listen to. Thanks.